I am 43, the 29th of April 1996 to the 28th of April 1997. Over. Tupac Shakur is dead. By Yaron Vag. It's September the 16th. I'm the furthest away imaginable from the coffee shop in Kentish Town. Not just physically, but also mentally. I'm in the small village of Lukela, right on the bank of the Congo River. The weather is unbearable. It's like the burst of heat you get when you open an oven door to check in your cake, but constant. The mosquitoes are mostly the size of small oranges. There was one specific mosquito that was following me around, or so I felt, for a few kilometres. I nicknamed him Big Papa and tried to reason with him and strike a deal, or a truce, if you will. It is not or written in stone that either of us must get bitten, smashed to pulp, I kept telling him. Big Papa was having none of it. It's been business doing pleasure with you, Big Papa. I'm in the Congo with Zed on an adventure that was somewhat documented in a previous book. But that is not what this is about. There are no coffee shops in Lukela, but there is a small grocery store where you can get a cup of coffee. A group of kids were outside talking. I don't understand what they were talking about, but I did catch the word Tupac, which they repeated. A minute later, I found out that Tupac Shakur had been shot dead a few days earlier. Western entertainment news travels slow in the Congo, but this one hit hard. As other kids joined in the gathering and the mourning, it became clear what was needed now was an improvised funeral. The kids, about 17 of them, formed a line and started marching. I followed quickly, which only seemed to encourage them. About 5 minutes in, another kid joined. He had a painting of Tupac, which I believed he painted himself. It was not one of those portraits of Tupac you see young people wear all over the world, but more a series of lines and shapes, almost a Basquiatin-esque in nature, which formed the image of the late rapper. The young artist was accompanied by a girl carrying a boombox. It was playing Dear Mama. The two joined in the funeral march, which now felt more like a parade. After a few more minutes of walking, we arrived at an area which offered softer land. As the music kept playing, a couple of kids dug a hole. They looked rather confused afterwards. I suppose they didn't plan ahead as to what to put in it. One of them tried to convince the artist to sacrifice the Tupac painting and bury it. I did not understand a word of the exchange they had, but the decibel levels alone assured me this was not going to happen. And then suddenly the music stopped. Just as it did, all the arguing ceased too. Everyone turned their heads at the little girl with the boombox. She looked grumpy. She yelled something in her native language. "This is not how a great rapper should go out," I imagine she said. It really could have been anything, yet it could only be this thing now. The girl continued by taking the CD out from the boombox and handing it to one of the grave diggers. There was no case for the CD or any inlay. I don't think it was an actual official CD, but all the better. The grave digger accepted it and placed it in the grave. Each participant, including me, followed by taking a fistful of fresh land in our palm and threw it into the grave. We all returned to the village. Not in a form lined, but more in a cluster. A ball of energy fueled by a ritual done right. Some of the kids went their own way. and I went to the grocery store to finally buy that cup of coffee. The girl and the artist went inside the grocery store too. They tried to convince the owner to hang the painting on the wall. The girl did most of the talking, and soon it was done. The artist even squeezed a couple of juice bottles out of what all of a sudden turned into a transaction. I tell you, this kid knows much more than I about the business side of the art world. I wasn't trying to inject myself into the situation, but I felt some specific words might serve this fine painting. I asked everyone's permission and wrote down a poem on a white piece of paper that I had. It is by Lee Goldberg, and it's called What Does a Person Need? What does a person need? At least one person, another, who reflects his eyes, echoes his voice, who shatters the existential loneliness, the transparent walls between the inner and the outer and the inner, who holds the soul with trembling hands, the naked, the fragile, and acts softly with it. A person just needs a person.
Under, I've Never Been Back, by Chris Lloyd. During the first few months of my 43 years, I'd suffered from toothache. It brought to mind my first visit to the dentist. I remember entering into a tall, gleaming white office, which smelled of rubber. I then remember waking up in a sink full of blood and intense pain in my face. The experience understandably left me with a few issues, and here I was, some 30-odd years later. Toothache again. I could fly out to Northern Australia and get the whole shebang done over there. Euthanasia. Fuck it. It's legal there now, after all. However, never the defeatist, I decided to go to the local dentist and get it fixed. Two extractions, I was told, there and then. I gripped onto the armrest as the mask-wearing guardian of my mouth did their best to ease any pain. They failed, and yet, unlike that early terrifying encounter, I find myself enjoying the feeling. Every jolt down the back of my neck, a revelation. Over the remaining year, I became addicted. All summer, I could only think about that dental surgery. Where once the idea of merely sitting in a dental waiting room filled me with anxiety, now the thought of the drill grinding into my teeth filled me with pure excitement. Problem was, my teeth weren't that bad. As the nation was gripped by England's need to win the Euros, I was gripped with the idea of revisiting that dentist. Visit two was for a clean and polish, but whilst I savoured the somewhat infrequent stabbing of the metal probe, a sadness enveloped me that this mild invasiveness was all I was to receive. I needed more. Autumn arrived, and I yearned to be in that chair. It was all I could think about. My wife, kids, colleagues, I had no time for them. They were an abstract oxygen source at best, something that was there to apparently keep me grounded, but utterly devoid of my thoughts. One afternoon, my son was banging on about some go-kart contraption he'd seen on some TV show, asking me if I could make him one in the shed. I wanted him to just fuck off, but the mere mention of the shed ignited an idea in me so perfect, I gave him a massive hug, promising him that I will eventually sort something out. I never entertained the idea of making that go-kart, of course. I spent the afternoon mentally plotting my next trip to the dentist. I phoned up to get an emergency appointment for the next day so they could fix the chipped tooth that I procured whilst eating a rather troublesome menthol sweet. Seed sown, I retired to the shed to procure a rough file before repeatedly smashing myself in the upper right incisor with the tip of said file. I could see the pain. I could feel the pain, but I didn't enjoy the pain. The only thing that kept me repeating the tiny jabs of metal to enamel was the thought of the dentist having to physically pull the entire tooth out of my jawbone. The dentist saw through the whole thing. The attitude shown towards me on my previous two visits were of the caring nature, but I now noticed a more sceptical vibe, especially when I requested no anaesthetic. If the thought of the drill was ecstasy last time round, then this extraction was pure opium. Every twist and yank of the forceps created a noise in my skull like an internal Aphex Twin. I could feel my jawbone vibrating and the taste of iron causing a drowning sensation. It was everything I hoped for and more. Before it was over, I was already planning my next visit. En route home, I stumbled into a toy shop to buy the go-kart for my son as a thank you for inspiring me to get the toolkit out. Why did he want a tatty homemade one anyway? They're all practically the same. He'd be able to ride it whether it was made by either me or Mattel. I could nip in and out the store and then be back in the tool shed by early evening. When I turned up unannounced to the dentist the next morning with six more half-broken teeth and a look of desperate joy on my face, I was ushered into the chair rather quickly. I was insistent that all teeth should be removed. The dentist and his assistant left the room, no doubt to get the heartiest of pliers. When they returned, they were accompanied by an officious-looking lady, a look of consternation on her face as she approached me cautiously. I then noticed two large figures behind the frosted glass of the surgery door and knew that I had been rumbled as potentially psychotic. Itself a psychotic notion, I'd finally beat my dental phobia. And that's progress, was it not? However, with hindsight and all that bollocks, Balfi got the tip off on my delicate state from my wife, and money was put up to place me in a secure unit for a short while. I spent my time wisely fobbing the doctors off, telling them what they wanted to hear. It was a ludicrously easy game to play. I acted the model of compliance and was home with the kids by Christmas. I knew deep down that I'd possibly gone a bit too far, but the TV kept telling me that 1997 meant New Year, New Me. I needed to make one final visit necessary to spare my family the repetition of this madness. For my next and hopefully final trip to the dentist, I required specialist help. February 1st. I decided that I needed every remaining tooth knocking from my skull. To carry out such a job needed someone with the right level of sadism and expertise. I needed Gimpo. I'll spare you the full detail, but it involved a desolate piece of wasteland under a flyover on the M25, a somewhat acidic solution, and a pair of tough pliers. A mere 20 minutes after arrival, Gimpo had finished the job perfectly, and I realised that an era was over. I phoned the dentist and spoke to a befuddled receptionist who couldn't make any sense of my request, as my plea for help was hard to decipher when filtered through a pulp of singed gums, cut lip, tooth shards, and gelatinous orbs of hardened black blood. By the time I was back in the dentist chair, I'd passed out. When I came to, I was back in the same unit where I feigned compliance last time. This time, the proclamations of sanity that flowed through the gleaming dentures that I wear to this day were nothing but the truth. I've never been back.